In 1960, a couple of very important things happened. Within the realm of the organized communist movement, 1960 saw the codifying of what it was now called the de-Stalinization period. You recall that the General Secretary of the Communist Party, Nikita Khrushchev, de-Stalinized the Communist Party. But for years, theoreticians in the ranks of the revolution had been studying the works of a little-known communist theoretician by the name of Antonio Gramsci. I mentioned Gramsci earlier to say that in 1922, Gramsci went to view the goings-on in the Soviet Union. And while a committed Marxist and a materialist and a Hegelian, Antonio Gramsci, being a man of the West, went and observed what was being done there, what was being planned in the international communist movement, and Gramsci said, it won't work. This will never beat the West. You will never beat the West economically. So when Khrushchev, and at the moment he started his de-Stalinization tirades, pounding his shoe, we will bury you, he knew better. Because at the 21st Party Congress going on in that same year, a seminal shift took place where Gramsci's writings were now mandated by the party leadership to the party theoreticians. And what is it that Gramsci wrote? Well, first of all, let me just tell you a little bit about Antonio Gramsci. After he came back, he founded the Italian Communist Party. His co-founder was Togliatti. Togliatti is generally accorded that title, but it was a combination effort of Gramsci and Togliatti. And he started a paper in Milan to develop Marxist materialist ideas called The New World Order, was the name of the paper. And then as Mussolini's power grew in Italy, Mussolini viewed the communist socialist as a threat to his national socialism. And Antonio Gramsci, along with a number of other communists, was thrown into jail. And Gramsci was like so many disaffected intellectuals. He was physically wasn't a very good specimen. He had kind of a gimpy leg, and he wasn't very healthy, but he was bright and diabolical, and he hated the West. And what Gramsci did during those 9 years in Mussolini's jail was to write prolifically about what he called a new hegemony, a new power mechanism. And the essence of Gramsci's strategy was that you will never beat the West in an economic way, and you will never socialize the West because of these ingrained ideas, the traditions of Judeo-Christianity, which are so ingrained in the Western mind for the whole mercantile idea, the idea of free enterprise and the individualism, the sovereignty of man. Gramsci said, the way we will take the West is to reach into it and pull the heart and soul of its culture out of it. We destroy its culture and we win. And so the Gramsci idea started to take root in the ideas of the socialist theoreticians. His papers, which had been smuggled out of prison, written and printed on basement presses. But by 1960, communist theoreticians had discovered Gramsci. I might also point out that simultaneous to that, the insiders of the establishment had come to the same conclusion. And a new science was born. It was called behavioral sciences. And the father of sociology, the first man appointed to the first chair of sociology at Harvard University, was a Russian expatriate by the name of Peterim Sorokin. And in Sorokin, we saw sociology start to become an accepted and important discipline in the humanities. There was one problem with Sorokin. Sorokin was a devotee and a devout defender of Western traditional values. So today, you can have a PhD in sociology and have never read a book on Sorokin. But the basis for sociology and the behavioral sciences, which was established in Harvard and then Yale and then the University of Chicago, all of these things set the stage for what slowly but surely started to call Western traditional values into question. You remember something in the 1960s called Sex Information and Educational Council of the United States, SECUS, and the high priestess of SECUS, Mary Calderon. And at that time they said, we have a problem in the high schools. Our problem is that young people are promiscuous. A newsflash. And that we are going to help them be less promiscuous if we institute sex education in the schools. And what has it wrought 20 years later? Some of us were arguing at the time, it's like giving a loaded pistol to an infant. Because through sex education in the schools, the whole idea of the mystery and the mystique of sex, to say nothing of the morality or immorality of the improper use, became just an academic pursuit. And what was sex education in the classroom 20 years ago or 25 years ago is now condom distribution in the classroom today. Remember this thing that we saw on television here recently about the group of high school boys out in Southern California who had this little cart group that called themselves the Posse or something. And their whole purpose was to hang scalps on their belt. How many conquests could they have? But the whole idea for the assault on culture, let's take it. Let's take a look at it. What has happened to art? Who were the celebrated artists of the age? The Picassos and the Jackson Pollocks. Anti-art. The traditional beauty of art gave way. Picasso had contempt, although he was a communist, a lifelong socialist. He had contempt for people who bought his paintings. He called it trash for trash. Jackson Pollock was even worse, a member of the Communist Party USA. And music. And arts and entertainment. And everywhere you look, the whole phalanx of values were starting to come under attack big time in the 1960s by the identifiable left and the establishment working in conjunction with them. Bottom and top working against the middle. Till today, we now have what is being called a culture war. Hardly a day goes by that you don't hear somebody talking about the culture war. And no longer is the supposition valid that Western culture is worth saving. Now the argument is there any of it worth keeping? As we dumb down and turn our culture into what Sorokin called a sensate culture, a culture motivated by the senses. And then one of the great behavioral scientists, one of the most celebrated men of his age, the Harvard professor B.F. Skinner, wrote a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity in the late 60s. And this became required reading for all the cognoscente and the liberal intellectuals, saying, and what Skinner offered was that there's more to the process of mankind than freedom and dignity. We've got to become part of a human whole where freedom and dignity give way to more important social structures. Skinner was a very candid man. He understood the role of the sensate and its importance. And he says, how do you tame people? You tame them like you do wild animals. You masturbate them. You get their preoccupation with sex to the point where it sublimates all other human values. And what do we see today? We see perversion brought to moral equivalence. And let's identify perversion. Perversion is a human act or tendency, or an act based on a tendency that is so compelling that it sublimates all other human actions and tendencies. That's what a perversion is. And there are a number of perversions. The one that we're hearing most about, of course, is homosexuality. But it's not the only one. A perverse activity like kleptomania can be so compelling that it sublimates all other human values. We just put a guy on trial, or just sentenced him up in Washington State, an arsonist. What about pedophilia? It's a tendency. It's like De Maistre says, I don't know about the heart of a rascal, but I know the heart of an honest man. It's horrible. What gives the homosexuals the right to think that their perversion should be institutionalized and mine should not? The truth of the matter is, they don't really believe that it is exclusive, and if they have their way, my perversion will be institutionalized as moral equivalent too. To the point where moral equivalency becomes a civil right. So in this process of bringing about the Gramsci strategy in the 60s, I am convinced, and I can't prove it yet, but I think I will be able to at some point in time, that the strategy for abandoning communism as part of that best enemy money can buy in the thesis-antithesis thing, that was accepted in 1960. My evidence for that was a defector, a Soviet KGB defector by the name of Anatoly Galitsyn, who defected in the early 1960s, came to the CIA and wrote and gave great testimony to the fact that sometime in the early 90s, early late 80s, the whole face of communism would change, the Berlin Wall would come down, it would all change. Golitsyn's book, New Lies for Old, explained what he saw as a seminal shift that took place in the early 60s at the 21st Party Congress here as a KGB defector. Of course, Anatoly Galitsyn is a pay to his pronunciations are about as important and as popular with the New York Times as mine. His book received about as much attention from the Literary Guild as has mine. But that's not important. Thoughtful people have read it, and thoughtful people have examined the evidence. No less a thoughtful person than the number two man in the CIA and the chief of counter-espionage, James Jesus Angleton, who believed that Gallitzin's revelations were absolutely spot on. Of course, Angleton was dismissed from the CIA soon. But in 1960, we had, by then, the basis for the shift of the so-called economic war and the Cold War to the culture war. Also in the early 60s, during the 1963 period under the Kennedy administration, there was something called together called the Iron Mountain Group. And then in 1967, one of the members of this Iron Mountain study group wrote a little book called Report from Iron Mountain. And he told it to a friend of his, Leonard Lewin, and he detailed what had gone on in this four-year interim period, or this four-year period under the Iron Mountain Study Group. And he used the unlikely pseudonym of John Doe. Not very creative on that front, I might add. But in the Iron Mountain Report, published in 1967, it caused quite a stir at the time. Supposedly the White House, as the author of the Iron Mountain Report, John Doe, whom I'm convinced was John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economist, who has denied writing it, but has, quote, sworn for its authenticity, close quote, and reviewed it under a pseudonym in the literary review, pointing out how authentic it was. In this report from Iron Mountain, this study group was called, under the auspices of the Kennedy administration, probably National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, to explore what would happen if the Cold War went away. What could we then use as an excuse for internationalism and the spending of government money? And the report said that part and parcel of the policy in place at that time and what must remain in place was a purposeful wasting of 10% of our gross national product. Purposeful wasting of our 10% of our GDP. So the study group explored a whole bunch of possibilities that could be a substitute for war. They thought, well, we might conjure up an intergalactic invasion. We can spend a lot of money on that. We can do an awful lot in the name of exploring space. Probably the best hope for their prospect was something they said they called developing a consciousness of environmentalism. That in 20 years could be used as a mechanism and as a replacement for war. Then, 3 years later, writing in Foreign Affairs, the quarterly magazine of the Council on Foreign Relations, the same man who wrote the article developing the word containment under the pseudonym X, George F. Kennan, in April of 1970, wrote a lengthy piece on the importance of saving the planet and environmentalism in international affairs. And it was a blueprint for using the environment or the ecological movement as a way to replace war, to give it the same sort of, quote, moral authority, as Henry James said, the moral equivalent of war, and thus the antecedents for the environmental movement began. And also in that same year, April of 1970, was the first Earth Day. Shortly followed thereafter by the appointment of Environmental Protection Agency. And as they say, the rest is history. And if you want to know how much history, I will toss in a commercial and tell you that within a matter of a few days, my new book, The Greening, will be out, and it will blow your socks off. The same group who created the agony, the war, the strategy for domination and internationalism, the surrender of individual sovereignty and national sovereignty, the same crowd created the environmental moral equivalent of war. The title of the book is The Greening. Kind of like The Howling. And you will note, as part of the culture war aspects of environmentalism, Mother Earth has become elevated to the position of goddess. There is only one species that the environmentalists don't like. Man. No. I'm not kidding here, folks. Man is the despoiler. Man is the waster. Man is the overpopulator. Man is the enemy. And what, when you boil it all down, the culture war and the eco war are one and the same. Control of natural resources and control of people. That's what environmentalism is all about. There isn't anything else. And it doesn't make any difference how specious, ridiculous, and discredited the arguments. I said that the first Earth Day was April 1970. I started observing environmentalism with more than a casual interest in 1970. I remember the college campus speeches and lectures that were going on. Dennis Hayes, the guy who founded the first Earth Day in 1970, gave us the 20th anniversary in 1990 with great fanfare and hoopla. And all around the country, professors and liberal intellectuals were giving speeches about the dangers to the environment. You'll be pleased to know that one of those dangers has not transpired. The concern at that time was a new ice age, not a global warming. There wasn't a speech on global warming. There was some speeches on a new ice age. The evidence for that got a little sketchy, so they created a new global warming and a greenhouse effect. It's as ludicrous as the ice age argument, but who cares? Everything is true except the facts. In 1970, one of the high priests, one of the real high priests, was a Stanford professor by the name of Paul Ehrlich, who won a PhD for his knowledge of butterflies. Listen, folks, I don't make this stuff up. I just report it. He wrote a book called The Population Bomb in 1970. Thereabouts, give or take a year. What he projected the world to look like by 1990, in 20 years, if the governments of the world, with the United States leading the way, didn't do all these things to stop population bomb, there would be famine and war and hunger. People stumbling over one another. Oh man, it was really going to be grim by 1990. 1990 rolled around. Ehrlich didn't apologize for what he wrote in 1970. He wrote a new book called The Population Explosion, and it got the same sort of accolades that the first book did. Everything was true except the facts. And when you have a philosophy that is hell-bent on making man the enemy, you have the essence of a culture war. And I can tell you now, without any qualification, reservation, or equivocation, the forces of Gramsci and the revolution, along with the establishment, have come together in the personality and the synthesis of William Jefferson Clinton. The Rhodes Scholar, who studied in Russia, who studied in Italy, whose mentor was Professor Carol Quigley at Georgetown, who has the morals of an alley cat and is seeking moral equivalency for it. Clinton is the synthesis. And if you doubt it, just take a look at the people around him. Partisan Republicans are beating their chests these days saying he's bogged down. His jobs package isn't working. His tax package isn't getting passed. His job stimulation thing. I gave a speech in New Orleans before the election. I said the problem will not be with what Clinton may or may not do on the economic front. The problem will be what he will do in the first 100 days to give the sensate culture moral equivalency. The first act as President of the United States was to call for the abolition of homosexuals in the military. And that was an interesting straw man, because while everybody is debating that one, the homosexuals are being appointed to everything from cabinet positions and everything on down throughout the whole of his administration. Your strongest qualification for getting a Clinton appointment is to be a sexual pervert. I am sorry, folks, it's the truth. Donna Shalala, Secretary of Health and Human Services, who as a cabinet minister stands over the largest budget of any cabinet in the department, at the March on Washington, April 25, Larry Kramer, head of ACT UP, says, screaming into the microphone, "Come on, Donna, admit what you are. We know what you are. All of us know what you are. Admit it. You're a lesbian." Didn't see that on nightly news highlights at 11, did you? Didn't see that in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Time Magazine, Newsweek. Same afternoon, Robin Tyler, mistress, miss it, miss person, whatever you call them, of ceremonies. Cameras rolling. Says, "I've got a secret. You want to know my secret? Hillary had a lesbian affair. Finally, there's somebody in the White House we can F." That missed the nightly news too, didn't it? The war is on, folks. In health care, you think health care is just about keeping people healthy? You think the same people who want to get rid of people because of overpopulation are worried about your health? If you buy into that, there's a bridge from the lower end of Manhattan over to the other side of Queens. I know that's for sale. You know what health care will do? It will fund perversion. It will fund abortion. It will fund the destruction of human life. It will fund the euthanasia. My mother's in a nursing home up in Gig Harbor where I live. And the good lady who runs the nursing home, Mrs. Glass, says, "Larry, you have no idea the pressure we are under here to pull the plug all the time." She says, "It is the official policy of the state of Washington to destroy life, not keep it." It's culture war. Tear the heart and soul out of the West. When Mikhail Gorbachev said, "Those who are relegating us to the dustbin of history will have another thought coming," he wasn't just whistling Dixie, as they say down in these parts. But it has come together. One of the projects that Paul and I are working on, just a sidebar, in addition to writing Insider Report, I co-publish a publication called Second Opinion, written by my courageous colleague, Dr. William Campbell Douglas, who's constantly pointing out all the cheap and natural and alternative therapies available. We've set something up called the Douglas Institute. outside the purview and the watchdog of the FDA, I might add, to help explore and examine all of these beneficial therapies around the world within the framework of the Douglas Institute. But we are at war, and they drew the line in the sand. And those of us who think that this war is something we can opt out of, oh yeah, you can opt out. But what about your kids or your grandkids? Can they opt out? Have you watched what's on MTV? Have you actually sat down and watched MTV? Have you ever been able to work your way through the lyrics of rap songs? You talk about the shock. It isn't something that's going to happen, folks. It's happening as we speak. And the war is on in earnest. And the name of the game, let me give you what Carol Quigley said, where he said it would go. Remember, this is Clinton's mentor. Quigley observed, "The individual's freedom and choice will be controlled within very narrow alternatives by the fact that he will be numbered from birth and followed as a number through his educational training, his required military or other public service, his tax contributions, his health and medical requirements, and his final retirement and death benefits. Keep your mouth shut, don't make waves, work for the company store, and you'll be just fine." The company store will come under numerous corporate logos, I might add. But that's the war we're in. And we're in a war for economic survival. Who's the attack against? You take a look at the Clinton proposal. Look, I sat and listened to his February 25th speech to a joint session of Congress. I took copious notes. It's cradle to the grave government, folks. Invest in tomorrow when communism has fallen, legions of poor children. We've got to stop consuming and we've got to invest. That's a new government buzzword. Fairness, $30 billion public service, lower interest rates, community development banks, environmental cleanup, national economic strategy, national health care, children vaccination, national program take care of, on and on and on. And after it was over, I was sitting out the next couple of days out the golf club after a round of golf, sitting in the 19th hole talking about things, and my golf partners said, "Larry, what'd you think of Clinton's speech?" I said, "He gave it as though there was no Constitution. It was as though the Constitution of the United States didn't even exist." And one of the guys in the group said, "What's the Constitution got to do with it?" Now, I'd have had a little sympathy had this been a 30-year-old. This was a 60-year-old. What's the Constitution got to do? The answer, in simple form, as I said to him, "You fool, everything." And because I have long since given up the idea of suffering fools gladly, I didn't hang around to chat with this numbskull. I went home. Because if at 60 years old he can ask, "What's the Constitution got to do with it?" I guarantee you, no matter how persuasive and loquacious I might be at the 19th hole, I wasn't about to change his mind, and I didn't have a mindset to even try. But I ask you, has anybody asked in the public world, what about the constitutionality of all this? Have you heard any of the loyal opposition talk about, hey, this could be unconstitutional? Is that question raised at all? And let me ask you how important the Constitution is to the American people. Let me tell you how important it is. The American people don't care about the Constitution. They don't know about the Constitution. They think they have constitutional protections. They think their citizenship is important. Let me tell you how important their citizenship is to them. You don't even have to be a citizen with the motor voter bill to cast a vote for every office of government at every level. The motor voter bill just passed both houses of Congress, will be signed into law, and anybody can vote in U.S. elections. Anybody in the country, and it doesn't make any difference where they're from, what they understand about the Constitution, nothing. That's how important our citizenship is to us. And you know what? I keep looking for the will to resist on the part of the American people to kick in. Remember that as Sun Tzu Wu, the Chinese warlord philosopher, writing in The Art of War in 500 B.C., the most brilliant treatise ever on war. Sun Tzu allowed that supreme excellence in warfare lies in the destruction of your enemy's will to resist in advance of perceptible hostilities. Supreme excellence in warfare. Where is the will to resist? At what point do the American people draw a line in the sand and say, no more? You know what? If I didn't give economic advice in Insider Report, I probably wouldn't have 1,000 subscribers. I have to sell people on the idea of how to get rich to be able to stuff some philosophy down their throats. Sad commentary, but indicative of the times. And let me ask you one question. If you go on the search for truth, what is the worst thing that can happen to you? You can find it. Because once you find it, then you got to do something about it. That's the horrible thing about the search for truth. If you keep searching, you'll find it, and then the onus shifts. As long as you can say, I didn't know, that may not be the best excuse, but at least it's something. But once you know, then you are required to do something about it. And people say to me, well, what should be done about it? Let me tell you what I think should be done about it. The other side knows, if we're going to take any lessons, they have codified all of these things. They've taken Mao and Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz and Gramsci, and they study it and they pore over it and they come up with the think global, act local. That's the buzzword of the eco movement. All politics is local, saith Tip O'Neill. Don't worry about what may happen in Washington State. Worry about what's going to happen in Midland and Odessa and West Texas. And I guarantee you that if you will do that, the people in Gig Harbor and Wana and Spokane and Tukwila, they'll might be doing the same. And for Pete's sake, stop getting caught up in this annual four-year mental hysteria of who are we going to elect as president. When Gary and I first wrote Nundare in 1971, Nixon was gearing up to run for re-election. We said, we don't know who the candidate will be, but we guarantee you it'll be some crazy liberal to the point that will ensure Nixon's re-election. His name was McGovern. And one of the young campaign workers of the McGovern campaign is now your president of the United States. And we said then, if the people who read and buy what we have to say in this book will forget the presidency and get involved in local politics and the congressional races, we can save this country. It's true. It's still true. You see, the other side gives the appearance of popular support. That's another strategy of Sun Tzu's. Create the appearance of popular support, so that you think you're the only people who believe this way. You're not. Our numbers are diminishing because of what's happening in the classroom and what's happening through the media. and the sensitizing and the sensate culture. But the window's still open. It's not closed. Remember, if there's any validity at all to the whole process of dialectics, as they become the thesis, where will the antithesis come from? We will not lose this battle, because this battle is an individual thing. We win or lose as individuals. We win or lose when we see our responsibility and we refuse to do something about it, or we do it. That's what being grown up is all about. I see my responsibility and I try to do it. That's really what it's all about. It's not easy. Sometimes it takes courage. Poor Paul was lamenting to me last night, "Gee, Larry, I'm really surprised by some people who won't be and aren't coming to this meeting." I said, "Paul, I've dealt with that problem for 30 years. Don't be surprised and mortified by who didn't show. Rejoice in who did." Because if the people that get in this room today, I told him last night, if just the people in this room decide they want to change the politics of West Texas, it will change. If the people in this room decide they want to change the emphasis of the culture war, it will change. And let me give a little plug for my newsletter, and I'm not going to go much beyond this. I take and I analyze these things on an international basis and on a national basis, how it's all playing out, what the insiders are doing. And then I do something I think is most important, for which I've been criticized. I point out to my readers how they can profit in their own investments out of what is happening in the real world. People say, "You're profiting off all this agony." No, I'm not. Didn't create it. Didn't create it, doing everything I can to fight it, but I have not met any freedom fighters queued up to accept a government check. When you get into that line, the war is over. Regardless of what you call it, whether you call it a subsidy, a dole, government contract. So you see, we have to keep ourselves strong economically. We have to try to get out of harm's way, because the truth of the matter, my friends, is we are fighting a rearguard action now. The synthesis, the coming together of the establishment, the Rhodes idea of Anglo-Americanism, the Gramsci idea of culture destruction are now occupying the White House. Not a pretty picture, as my son Josh would say. Let me attempt to answer your questions. How do I keep from getting shot? You know what I think has been my greatest protection? Speaking out, the fact that I am a public opponent. You see, the opposition knows well that they don't want to create martyrs. In fact, I'm convinced that if I got hit by a car tomorrow legitimately, or fell dead on a heart attack, or with a heart attack on Paul's golf course this afternoon, my readers would never believe it was natural. They'd know that somebody did me in. See? So I found out a long time ago, as did former defectors of the Communist Party, when people like Whitaker Chambers and numerous others I could name, they felt that that point where their life was most in jeopardy was from that moment they had defected mentally till the time they could get public. Once they got public, they had protection. Yeah.
Would you correlate the ascendancy of the U.S. dollar as reserve currency back in 1958 to what has happened with the increase in money supply in the intervening years, and what currency you think will be the next reserve currency?
Yes. Through the creation of the Bretton Woods Agreement, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the dollar became the reserve currency to the world, as you know. And as such, it, quote, was as good as gold. That condition existed until August 15, 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window and no longer would make the dollar as good as gold. There was a announced deflation. Still, in all, most people don't recognize the official price of gold is $42.22 an ounce. That's how the central governments of the world put it on the balance sheet. But now there has been a plan in place for some time. I first wrote about it about 4 years ago. It was a lengthy monograph, appeared in the pages of Council on Foreign Relations Quarterly, Foreign Affairs, written by Harvard professor Richard N. Cooper, as head of a study group for a group founded by the Trilateral Commission. Trilateral Commission was just the latest of these international groups that grew out of the Ruskin idea. The Trilateral Commission was founded in 73, but in 83 they founded a monetary think tank called the Institute for International Economics. And the chairman of the Institute for International Economics is Peter G. Peterson. And the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations is Peter G. Peterson. And the executive vice president of the Institute for International Economics is Anthony Solomon. And the executive vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations is Anthony M. Solomon. And one of the Harvard professors, Richard N. Cooper, wrote a piece about how to bring about monetary stability in the world. So I think what we're going to see very soon, already the steps are being taken to create it, is a three-part world, a trilateral world, if you will, with the D-mark being the reserve currency to the Euro-African, the dollar being the reserve currency to the Western Hemisphere, and the yen being the reserve currency to East Asia, and the fixed exchange rate mechanism will be set up between the D-mark, the dollar, and the yen, out of which all other currencies will measure their value in what is called the Baker Plan when he was Secretary of the Treasury, through a basket of commodities including gold and oil and cattle and... But the mechanism for creating, first of all, a regional currencies, the Maastricht Treaty in Europe, which was going to accelerate the whole process of a one European currency, history turns on strange things. A bunch of Danes, just a handful, upset an apple cart that was boy, you talk about that ball was rolling, and these Danes, the Danes. I mean, have you ever been to Copenhagen? It's an incredible place. Certainly not you'd call restrained people. But somewhere there was a common sense and they voted down that Maastricht Treaty and boy, it set back that whole European common currency thing and the European Union and all that. Boy, the insiders have been scrambling. So, you don't know. You know, history turns on strange things. And the longer I study history, the more fascinated I become with God's sense of humor. Yes?
Ross Brown's closest friend is a man by the name of Tom Luce, his lawyer. Whenever he does anything exciting, he says, call Tom. Tom Luce ran for governor 4 years ago. And at the time he ran for governor, I happened to catch a small quip in the paper that his finance chairman was a man by the name of Peter O'Donnell. Peter O'Donnell, to those of you who are old enough to remember this, has been, to my knowledge, for 30 years, the top Rockefeller man in the state of Texas. What does that tell you?
Well, the interesting thing about Ross Perot, if you look deep enough, my colleague George Grant did a little quick book on Ross Perot that was pretty insightful. But Ross Perot certainly doesn't find government an anathema. He built EDS with government contracts at the state and federal level. And when Ross Perot was out doing his carrying on about, we're just flat going to go down to Washington and fix it. I wrote a piece in Insider Report saying, Mr. Perot, you had a chance to fix the largest industrial institution in the history of man, the General Motors Corporation, of which you were the largest shareholder. In a year that you became the largest shareholder, they showed a profit of $4.5 billion. You weren't interested in fixing GM, you were interested in grabbing your green mail and throwing arrows at the rest of the GM board. With friends like you, GM sure didn't need enemies. If you can't fix GM, how are you going to fix the country, Mr. Perot? Ross Perot has contempt for the American people, as is evidenced by the arguments and the sophistries and the one-liners he uses when he talks to them. He is a contemptible man for whom I have an absolute anathema. And with that, I'll stop hedging. Yes.
Who really controls the Federal Reserve?
The Federal Reserve is controlled by the banking system. There have been a number of books written about the secret owners of the Fed Reserve, and the Fed has never been audited, and it never has been. But the Federal Reserve is more important as a political institution than it is as a process for profit through surreptitious ownership. Let me give you an example. As somebody who's been a commodities broker and writing about it and analyzing it and giving investment advice, and as Paul pointed out, I have a service for speculators called Insider Express. If I were simply a member of the Federal Open Market Committee and knew that I was going to be shifting and changing the rediscount rate tomorrow morning, that's all the profit motive I need. Okay? That's like having a look at tomorrow's Wall Street Journal. I don't have to worry about whether or not the Fed itself makes a profit, because it does get audited to this degree that it does turn over its profits to the Treasury at the end of every year. There have been a lot of very anti-Semitic books written about the Federal Reserve to have you believe that it's all run by a bunch of Jewish bankers. When you start looking at the banks, the Jewish influence has certainly been sublimated in the last few years. Dennis Weatherstone, the head of the House of Morgan, would find it a little difficult to go looking for the Hebrew in the woodpile, so to speak. Yes?
When do you think we'll have a constitutional convention?
I don't know, Curly. Thank God there's been enough work out there at the state level to discourage the calls for a constitutional convention. This work must continue to go on because this effort on the part of the CONCON proponents is still going on. But every time we can get a state to reconsider its call for a constitutional convention, it sets it back further. So I don't know. Yes?
Well, I was just going to say that I have a friend who is in the Bush administration and works as personnel at the White House, and she's now leaving. She can't stand it. And she said everybody that's been hired to replace the people that she worked with are coming in at 10, 15, 20, 30,000 more. They're hiring more people. They have a new system that doesn't work. And almost everybody's gay. Yes, almost everybody. You can hardly get a job there unless you're gay.
Well, that was interesting. I observed that same thing through my contacts in Washington. This is the first time in 30 years that I recall the Secret Service being the source of the leaks on the White House, and they are.
They are, absolutely.
And the head of the Secret Service White House detail is being replaced, I might add. So the Secret Service people are being purged. Everybody in Washington knows about the profligacy of the Clintons and the carryings-on in the White House. Heck, I even had an NBC newsman call me the other day and talk to me like an Insider Report subscriber, of which he was. So it isn't that people don't know. It's just that they're afraid to do anything about it.
Nobody writes about it.
No, but I'll tell you, it's starting to come out. It's coming out in a lot of places that won't be able to be ignored much longer. The front page article of a May 27th article of an Australian daily had an article about all of this. It's coming out in the English press. The problem is not that it isn't coming out, because it will come out. What scares the living dickens out of me is what will be the American public's attitude when it does come out. That will be there. That's crunch time. Will the American people care enough to get behind a major movement to correct it? Yes, ma'am.
People who are ill coming into this country. We spend millions of dollars and many hours and live TV and go to some things. Yet the thing is open wide open among you.
Yes. It would almost make you believe that there's a policy to destroy America, wouldn't you? I said it's enough to make you think that there might be a policy out there to destroy America.
My father worked in public medicine, and he had ideas about things like that. But it seems so silly.
Well, it's not only silly, it's lethal, you see. We're not talking about silliness here, ma'am. We're talking about lethal.
Yes, sir.
And today, the only people who get prosecuted for the lethal conduct pursuant to anything having to do with AIDS are doctors who say that their patients are AIDS-ridden. They're the ones who get prosecuted. AIDS is a politically protected disease. Ask any physician. And ladies and gentlemen, let me conclude. I'm running out of steam. And I do want to remember what my prof told me. I am going to quit before you will, I hope. I very much appreciate your coming. I appreciate you letting us use the paraphernalia of the telecommunications age to videotape this program. And this tape will be available. Because I don't know how many more times I'll be able to give this speech. You think it's bad hearing, you ought to do the research putting it all together. I want to thank you for coming. It's been a delight to be with you in West Texas. And remember that, as I said earlier, the terrible thing about the search for truth is what happens when you find it, and then what do you do about it? And remember that all politics is local. Don't expect the people across the country to do something that you won't do in your own backyard. Thank you.
Larry Abrams has two books available. The first is entitled Call It Conspiracy, an update on this bestseller called Dare Call It Conspiracy. The second is entitled The Greening. Both are available from Book, Line, and Thinker at P.O. Box 1878, Fort Collins, Colorado, zip 80522, or phone area code 303. The number is 493-3793. Larry also has a subscription intelligent newsletter entitled The Insider Report. It costs $199 for 1 year or $358 for 2 years. It is available from Publishers Management Corporation, P.O. Box 84903, in Phoenix, Arizona, zip 85071. They also have a toll-free number by dialing 1-800-528-0559. God bless you now. Goodbye.